actually dug out my heaviest coat, which I regretted immediately when I landed on Sunday afternoon because it was beautiful and nice outside, and I regretted more yesterday. Now my guilty feeling faded a little bit when I see the rain today. So, well, the most important thing, of course, is to thank my collaborators. Wenxin Ding is a former student. Xinhua Lai is a former postdoc. Nick Bonsteel, which I think many of you know well, is a colleague, and we are all at the Magnet Lab and the Florida State University. Alex Seidel is now on the faculty of Washington University in St. Louis, but we actually started thinking about some things that I'm going to talk about when he was a postdoc at the Magnet Lab. So for those of you who know me, I tend to work on things that are experimentally relevant. So this is actually the first one-hour talk that I prepared that does not have a single experimental slide or experimental data. So when I gave this talk elsewhere, I started with an apology and explanation why this is still interesting, justifying talking about entanglement a little bit. Since this is a theoretical physics institute, where I think entanglement is best understood and appreciated, so I will skip the apology, skip the justification and everything else, and go directly to the summary of results. So I'm mostly going to be talking about entanglement entropy, about which the most important result or best known result is the area law, which applies to ground states. Now, like all laws in physics or life, there are exceptions, and part of this talk is about the exceptions. So it turns out, above one dimension, until relatively recently and before our work, the only known example where this area law is violated is actually a surprisingly simple state, namely free Fermi gas state, where there is a Fermi surface. And we expanded that result, if you wish, in two different directions. So we first extended that to the case of Fermi liquid, which is the interacting fermion system, but also with a Fermi surface. And we used high-dimensional bosonization to show that exactly the same violation actually occurs there. In a separate piece of work, we showed that Fermi surface is not the only thing that gives you this violation above 1D. You can also have the so-called Bose surface, which in some exotic Bose liquid states, which I'm going to explain what they are. And there is a very similar logarithmic violation of the area law as well. Okay, so we have these more examples of logarithmic violation, but what are they good for? Well, I'm not totally sure, but I don't know if there are holographers in the audience. In some cases, you actually don't know how to write down a wave function for the ground state, but nevertheless, you can use geometry to calculate RT formula, whatever, to calculate entanglement entropy. And if you find such a log violation, you can identify that as being due to, well, I guess before our work, a Fermi surface, but now we argue that both surfaces can do the same thing. Beyond that, I think this is a preprint that came out a couple of weeks ago. We actually can use the specific way the coefficient depends on the way you cut the system to actually even determine the shape of the Fermi surface or both surface. I will be very brief about this part. But up to this point, everything is about ground state entanglement properties, and in particular, entanglement entropy. What about excited states? And I'm particularly talking about highly excited states where you have not just a finite excitation energy, but actually a finite excitation energy density, meaning that the excitation energy is a extensive quantity. So there, what you expect is actually a volume law, namely the entanglement entropy scales the same way as thermal entropy, which of course we know is an extensive quantity. But there are very few explicit results that actually tells you this is indeed true. So coming back to the original starting point, we were able to show that for the free Fermi gas states, there is actually a remarkable duality between ground state and highly excited states, which actually turns the area law, well, with log correction, which turned out to be unimportant, to volume law. If another way to say the same thing, which of course I'm going to explain, is that the area law for the ground state and the volume law for the excited states in this particular case can be shown to be the two sides of the same coin. Now, having the entanglement entropy scaling the same way as the thermal entropy does not mean they are the same thing. But under appropriate conditions, in particular, if the so-called eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, or ETH, is valid, then these two things are not only scaling the same way, they are actually the same thing. And again, for the free fermion case, we were able to show under appropriate conditions this is indeed the case, and thermalization does actually emerge. So, for free fermion, yeah. Now, of course, this is a very lengthy summary, almost as long as the abstract, I guess, I sent, which I was actually embarrassed about. So if you are like me, you can take at most one message out of one talk. So in that case, my recommendation would be taking the last one out, and I'm going to summarize in a different way. So the point is that we have learned in school, in order to do statistical mechanics, we have to do some kind of ensemble averaging of states. Conceptually, the simplest is the microcanonical ensemble, but in practice, canonical or grand canonical ensembles might be more convenient. Now, if ETH holds, then what this is saying is that you can actually reduce the whole ensemble to a single eigenstate without any averaging, but nevertheless, statistical mechanics and the corresponding thermal entropy would emerge from entanglement between a small subsystem and the rest of the system. So even though the whole system is in a single eigenstate, the environment that actually separate from the system, that subsystem they are interested in, is playing the role of a thermal bath. And we were able to show this is indeed the case for this remarkably simple free fermion state. Now, I also realized that ETH means different things to different people. So for this talk, the definition is that I have a big system in a single energy eigenstate, and I look at the reduced density matrix of a sufficiently small subsystem, and we are going to show that this reduced density matrix takes the form of the thermal density matrix. So that's a summary of this talk. We are working on that, so don't say it yet, okay? Probably, but with a caveat, without BEC. BEC would actually, yeah. Yeah. Above the condensation temperature, yeah. So this is a summary of the entire talk, but I guess I still have 50 minutes left. So let's go back to the very beginning. So it's probably not necessary. So of course there are different ways to look at entanglement, but the most commonly used way is to carve out a subsystem in a big system and look at the reduced density matrix of the subsystem by tracing out degrees of freedom outside it. And essentially every physical quantity that you're interested in, but only having support in the subsystem can be studied using the reduced density matrix. And the entanglement entropy is the von Neumann entropy associated with this reduced density matrix. So as I mentioned, the most important result in this regard is the area law, which says that with very few exceptions, the entanglement entropy for the case where the whole system is in the ground state scales as the area of the subsystem. And it has been proven, I guess, for maybe not all, but most of the ground states of gapped local Hamiltonians, and actually even most of the gapless states above one dimensions also follow this area law. Now, this area law is so robust that people are actually looking for important physics in the subleading corrections to this area law. And in this regard, I guess Xiaogang and others have done this extremely important work pointing out that if you are in a topological phase, then you have this universal subleading correction that tells you what is the total quantum dimension of all the particles or quasi-particles in the system. And this has been a diagnostic of topological phases these days. I'm not going to discuss this in any detail, but actually it turns out even when you have conventional phases, let's say with broken symmetry, you can also have subleading corrections that can grow as fast as being logarithmic. So in some early work, this is probably my very first paper on entanglement, my student and collaborators have studied some special models with long-range order and found such a logarithmic correction. But in that direction, the important work were done by people here. I guess Roger is here, but Max maybe not yet, where they showed that this log coefficient actually is a measure of the number of Goldstone modes associated with the broken symmetry. So the message is that subleading corrections are useful as well, both for topological phases and for conventional phases. But that's of course not the subject of the talk. The subject of the talk is about violation of the area law, which means you have the entanglement entropy growing faster than this leading term that area law would actually tell you. So this violation, which usually happens in a logarithmic fashion, is actually very common in 1D. Essentially, any critical 1D system would give you such a violation. And the most important example is when it's a conformal field theory, CFT. In which case, the log coefficient is actually universal. So I guess for this audience, it's not necessary. In the 1D case, you would have, let me see, d minus 1 would be 0. So that would, area law would tell you that the entanglement entropy would actually saturate. But when you have something that's growing indefinitely with system size, that's a violation. And usually, the growth is in the log form. So, so this CFT situation is best known, but essentially any other 1D critical systems would also give you a log where the coefficient may not be as easy to identify. In particular, in this work by Rafael and Moore, they pointed out that a class of one-dimensional distorted critical points have a log violation, and we did some follow-up work that's closely related. So now let me actually talk about a specific example which is relevant to what I'm going to talk about later, which is just the simple one-dimensional fermions. So that, of course, is an example of a C equal to 1 conformal field theory. Now, in this case, you can actually write down the wave function and use the wave function to calculate the entanglement entropy, and that has been done, and indeed, the outcome is this result with C equal to 1. Now, in 1D, you can actually do the same thing many, many different ways. And for this free fermion case, you can also bosonize them, in which case you would get a free boson theory, which is yet another example of C equal to 1 CFT. So you get the same result, which you which has to be the case. Now, the advantage of this bosonization approach is it allows you to include interactions. Now, in that case, you can't solve the fermion wave function anymore. But the in the bosonized description, it's still free boson, and it's still a C equal to 1 CFT. And therefore, the conclusion is that the interaction does not change this log violation and does not change the coefficient of the log either. OK, so I'm going to come back to this a little bit later. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, above one dimension, this violation is much rarer. And before our work, the only known example is this free fermion Fermi gas case, in which case there is also a logarithmic violation. So this was almost 10 years ago now, and in particular, in this paper by Gilve and Klitsch, they used a mathematical result, well, I guess at that time at least it's a conjecture known as a Widom conjecture, not only to show that there is this log violation, they were also able to calculate or determine the coefficient of this log, which turns out to be a convolution of a real space boundary and a momentum space boundary. So in preparation for something I'm going to say later, so in order to define the entanglement problem, at least for free fermions, you need to specify two boundaries. So the state is specified by a boundary in momentum space, which is Fermi surface. So you know the state once you know what are the occupied states. And then you have to cut the system, and the cut is specified by the real space boundary. So it turns out the log coefficient is a convolution of the two. And the one thing that you notice is that it's invariant when you exchange these two boundaries. So that actually is this duality between momentum and the real space, which I'm going to use later on. Okay, so we not only know the presence of log, we also know the log coefficient. So I see log here and see log here. So for someone like me who received the early education in China, I guess Xiaogang and me would be the only people who experienced those years in which Marxism is a required course in college. And one of the things I remember, maybe the only thing I remember from those educations is that everything is related. So therefore I see a log here, I see a log there, so according to Marx, they must be related. So my involvement of this research started with trying to figure out what's the relation between these two logs, if any. So it turns out they are indeed closely related. So of course, I mean, this is a result for a high dimensional system, and these logs are for 1D systems. But I can always construct a high dimensional system by stacking 1D systems together. I mean, so it's not a generic or real high D system, but it is high D system in some way. So let me just stack, let's say, a bunch of 1D chains, and then do some cut and ask how the entanglement entropy would actually scale with the real space subsystem size. Well, in this case, it's easy now because these 1D chains are not coupled, so I just need to add up the logs from every single chain that actually intersects the real space boundary. So that becomes a counting game. But in order to bring the counting to a form that's similar to this Widom or what I sometimes call a Gilve-Klitsch formula, I need to actually turn this counting or summation into an integral. Well, integration is by itself already a summation, so that's easy at least for the real space part of it. So basically, all what I need to do is to add these up and divide that by the spacing between the chains. But one thing that's special about these decoupled 1D chains is that the Fermi surfaces are actually flat along the perpendicular to the chain direction, and in particular, the size of the Fermi surface is inversely proportional to the spacing of these 1D chains. So dividing by the 1D chain is the same as multiplying by the size of the Fermi surface, and therefore I can write that as a double integral of a real space boundary and momentum space boundary. But all what I'm doing really is just counting the number of these chains that intersect. And remarkably, you find exactly the right coefficient that the Widom or Gilve-Klitsch formula tells you. So this was to me a very simple sort of a sanity check, which was actually already discussed in my students' PhD prospectus. But Brian Swango published a PIL using similar arguments. So after seeing his paper, we decided to post this prospectus on the archive as well. Okay, so this is the initial attempt to actually make some sense out of the Gilf-Clich formula. But turns out, this actually can also be used as a starting point for the genuine 2D case or high dimensional case. So the crucial ingredient that we used is the fact that for these decoupled 1D chains, Fermi surfaces are actually flat. In the generic 2D state or high dimensional state, that's not the case, but we can always divide the Fermi surface into sufficiently small segments such that the curvature is actually negligible. Within each segment, well, Sansuk in the audience, he may argue that curvature is always important, but believe me, in this case, it isn't. And then, if you actually map these flat segments into some fake 1D systems, pretty much the same way as I did here in this toy model, then add up the contribution of all of these segments, again, you recover the GK formula. But again, I'm not getting any new results yet. I'm just getting a new understanding that's useful to me for this free Fermion result. But as we are going to get to later, this is actually the starting point of a high-dimensional bosonization scheme that allows us to include Fermi-liquid interactions and calculate if the interacting state also has a similar log violation. And we're going to get to that in a few minutes. So okay, so now we have a good understanding, at least I personally had a good understanding of where this log correction or log violation comes from. But that's for free fermions. Now the question is, what about bosonic systems? Can you actually have such log violation in a boson system? Well, the answer turns out to be usually no, because bosons behave very differently from fermions. Fermions, of course, satisfy the Pauli principle, so they tend to form a Fermi surface. But bosons, they either condense or localize. So when they both condense, they become a superfluid with the resultant Goldstone modes. That will give you a log correction, but not a log violation. And of course, if they localize, they will just give you the usual error law. So even when they condense and have these gapless Goldstone modes, these modes are gapless only on isolated points. So they don't lead to area law violation. But as we saw, in order to have an area law violation, you need to have an extended critical surface where the gapless modes actually are anchored. So by the way, let me mention that you can actually have spin models, strongly interacting spin models with emergent Fermi surface, let's say for spin nouns, and numerical work have shown or found evidence suggesting area law violation, but I would actually label these as due to Fermi surface as well. So that's actually not a new source of area law violation. On the other hand, there have been theoretical proposals of exotic bosonic phases in which the bosons neither condense nor localize, but form some kind of metallic phase. And it has been argued that these so-called both metal phases have both surfaces along which gapless bosonic excitations live. And the natural question is, do these phases violate the area law? And we were able to show that the answer is actually yes.
But that violation was seen numerically by BMRG on multi-lane ladders for these both metals, wasn't it, by less
motion? Yeah, but I mean, I you're right. But because it's a multi-lag ladders, they have been sort of reduced for 1D system.
Right, but it's basically a log L scaling.
Yeah. I think you're right, but I don't think they extrapolated to the 2D or high D limit.
Sure.
Yeah.
But it's
yeah.
The same mechanism, right?
I would say it's related. Yeah, it's pretty much the same mechanism as we're going to see. Yeah.
Because they're just arguing that you're cutting the both surface in this wide dimension.
When you put it that way, the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so let's actually consider the simplest possible case in which these low energy bosonic modes are actually free bosons. But with this very unusual dispersion, where, for example, omega squared goes as kx times ky squared. So the dispersion vanishes not just at a single point, but actually along, in this particular case, both x and y axis. Okay. So field theory that these people, I guess, where this Bose-Meadow phase was first proposed, Rodin has this unusual dispersion. But in order to do actually entanglement calculation, we have to regularize it. So we have to put them on the lattice. And that's actually very easy to do. What you do is just to periodize these dispersions. So kx becomes sine kx and ky becomes sine ky, et cetera, et cetera. So you can actually write down a coupled harmonic oscillator model, which gives rise to such a dispersion, but involving only short range couplings. So in this case, it involves only nearest neighbor and second nearest neighbor couplings. Because sine kx comes from nearest neighbor coupling along x direction, sine ky comes from nearest neighbor coupling along y direction. You just convoluted the two, so it's nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor. But you get this very exotic dispersion. So now let's do actually what Roger was suggesting, which is let's just cut it along a particular, cut it in a particular way, which actually is translationally invariant along, let's say, the y direction. So the convenient thing of this cutting is it respects translation symmetry along the y direction. So one source of technical difficulty of calculating entanglement entropy is you have to cut a system, and the cut breaks the translation symmetry. So here we have to break translation symmetry somehow, but let's actually do it in such a way that some translation symmetry is actually preserved, in this case along the y direction. What that means is you can actually perform transformations that respect the symmetry and therefore does not mix up degrees of freedom inside and outside. So a natural thing to do is to perform a Fourier transform along the y direction, so that the modes are labeled by a y direction momentum and the x direction coordinate. And the modes that actually has a fixed y momentum actually decouple. So then you actually get a set of 1D chains labeled by a y momentum. Okay. Then to calculate entanglement entropy, then you pretty much do the same thing. You do a counting. Now in the momentum space, and just add up the contribution from all of these gapless modes. So now the difference between the usual case and this case becomes obvious, because in the usual case the modes are gapless only at the origin, so you only have one ky that gives you a log, so that actually shows up as a subleading correction. But now for every ky, you have actually gapless modes, and therefore they're all critical. So therefore, the coefficient of the log is actually determined by the number of ky that you have, which is nothing but the number of chains you have. You just add all of them up, and you find that you have a log that has a coefficient that grows linearly with the size of the boundary. And that, of course, is already a log violation, along the same argument that Roger is giving. But this, of course, is in some sense too trivial. It's basically a 1D argument, and it's not so obvious if you have a generic way of cutting the system, can you actually still have this log violation. And we were able to show that actually for almost all arbitrary ways to actually cut a system, you are going to get a violation. And to do that, we have to use a mathematical result, which is a very important one, which is so-called strong subadditivity, which relates the entanglement entropy of different ways of cutting the system through an inequality. So, yeah. Yeah.
You have condensation at the ground state?
No. So, okay. So the point is,
you have conservation bottom number?
No, these are not U1 bosons. So for the lattice model that we're discussing, it's just a bunch of harmonic oscillators. There's no U1 symmetry.
But how this
J
means a different particle?
J is actually a lattice site.
A lattice
site. So that's a lattice label.
So,
so basically, think about this as, yeah, exactly. So it's just like a crystal. These are phonons, yeah.
Oh, right.
Except the phonon spectrum is like this instead of your linear phonon.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Phonon.
Yeah.
But when you're calculating this, the phonon ground state, the entanglement of the phonon ground state.
Yeah.
Do you have some nice formula? You know, for the fermion, there's a nice formula they can do it.
Right.
For the boson.
You have something very similar, except you have to be careful with some zero modes, which give you an infinite contribution, which we carefully remove by applying anti-periodic boundary conditions, so that we remove that thing. Yeah. So it's almost as easy as a free fermion case. Yeah. Right. Okay. So let's say we want to actually show that you would have a log violation for not a translationally invariant cut, but let's say a square cut, which breaks translation symmetry both in x and y directions. So the way to do that is to use a strong subactivity inequality and view the square as overlap of a belt that has translation invariance along the x direction and another belt along the y direction, which also has translation invariance, so that I can use this earlier result, okay? So using the strong subactivity inequality, you can show that the joint area, which is a square, has an entropy that is bounded above by these belts. So that, of course, gives you an upper bound that grows as a log of the boundary size. But of course, that doesn't prove you have a violation because that's an upper bound. But you can actually do the opposite to actually set up a lower bound, which is you can repeat the square along the x direction and construct a belt out of the square. So then the entropy for the square shows up on the other side of the inequality, and it gives you a lower bound, which is also logarithmic. And you can do that in the other direction as well. So then you find that this entropy is bounded both above and below by the log, and therefore you prove that it must violate the error law in the logarithmic fashion. And the bound can be actually fairly tight. Let's say if your subsystem happens to be 1/4 of the total system, then you find that the log coefficient for the upper and lower bounds differ just by a factor of 2. So this, to us, is a pretty good bound. Now, what about subsystems with arbitrary shapes? Well, so as long as you have a single edge that's actually flat, you can use the same trick. First, you can use inversion symmetry to actually flip the system and then, or clone it, and then put them together. Now you have two edges, both flat on both sides, and then you can repeat it and construct a belt system out of it, and again, establish a lower bound that actually grows logarithmically. The only thing we are not able to do is you don't have any flat edge. Now, in this case, it's totally inconceivable that it doesn't violate the area law, because you can always cut it into two with a flat edge in between. Now, each of them would actually violate the area law logarithmically. But if the total system doesn't violate it, then all the log violation would have to come from the entanglement between these two subsystems alone, so that seems to be inconceivable, so we wouldn't worry about that. Okay, so summary at this point. So we now find that we have logarithmic violations of the area law for both free boson or free fermion systems. What we have done for the boson case can be viewed as the bosonic version of the Wolf-Gilchrist result for the free fermions, and we have expanded the domain of the area law violation. But then the question is, can you generalize this to interacting systems? Yeah.
So at this point, how much
So we cannot prove it, but in this most recent paper, we claim that the coefficient is twice. I have to go back quite a bit. Is twice this. The reason is, if you look at the dispersion, when you go across the Fermi surface, it's linear but chiral. So if you wish, if you map that onto a CFT, that's C equal to 1/2. But when you look at the boson dispersion, it's non-chiral. So that's C equal to 1. So therefore, for the same surface, the Bose surface will give you twice as big a log coefficient as the Fermi surface. These are all lattice models. So no, there's no UVPs.
If there's the L in front has a length scale.
There's also no. Actually, the coefficient of the log has no UVPs. But the log the L of course is always multiplied by a momentum scale. So there is no this is not field theory. Okay. So there is no UV divergence. Everything's finite. Okay, so everything is also non-interacting. So can we actually generalize this to interacting systems? So what we try to do is to ask, what would happen if we turn on Fermi interaction but stay within the Fermi liquid phase? So in this case, you cannot write down a fermion wave function to actually do the calculation, but we can still work with an effective theory using a high-dimensional bosonization, and this patching scheme that helped me understanding the Gilov-Clich result is actually the starting point for high-D bosonization. So it's slightly technical, but if you are familiar with 1D bosonization, it's actually not that different. So basically, if you look at a single patch, as I said, it's really behaving more or less like a set of decoupled 1D chains. The main technical difficulty is actually a notation. So you probably recognize that you can introduce these boson fields, the gradient of which is related in this case to the patch density, but except that now the gradient is actually a vector, so therefore it has to be dotted into the normal vector of the patch, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to do a lot of bookkeeping when you actually deal with coupling between different patches. But at the end of the day, the point is that if you only include forward scattering, which is the Fermi liquid interaction, you end up getting a quadratic theory, very much like the Luttinger liquid theory in 1D, except in this case, what you get out of it is not a non-Fermi liquid, but actually a Fermi liquid. So normally you would actually claim victory at this point and say, okay, I have reduced everything down to a quadratic theory, and therefore I can calculate anything you want. But again, as I said, for entanglement, it's actually not that trivial because you have to cut it, and when you cut it, it breaks the symmetries that you actually use to set up the formalism, and a lot of nasty things happened. So initially I thought that you can actually calculated the entanglement entropy for this bosonized description, bosonized theory for Fermi liquid exactly. But my student was able to show, actually, especially with help with Alex Seidel, were able to show that it's actually essentially impossible. But instead of, that actually issue, et cetera, but instead of calculating it exactly, he was able to find a way to calculate the correction to the entanglement entropy perturbatively in terms of the Fermi liquid interaction, but actually sum this perturbation series and show that order by order, there is actually no correction to the log coefficient. So there is quite a bit of technicality, which I'm going to skip today, but the conclusion is that the coefficient of the log is actually not renormalized by the Fermi liquid interaction. No, it doesn't enter at all. Right. Yeah. So, you mean at the area law level? Yes. Yes. But not at the not the log times area. Yeah, you're right that there are actually corrections, but not at the log level. It's only the area log level. Yeah. So that's the conclusion of that work. So that's good news because that means the log coefficient tells you something about the Fermi surface, which is not sensitive to the presence or absence of interaction. And in this recent work, which I'm only going to flash here, we showed that actually for specific ways of cutting the system, like a translationally invariant cut, what you're really measuring is a cross section or the projection of the Fermi surface onto a particular direction. And that's a measure of this area, which is exactly what you measure in a quantum oscillation experiment. So I have to make some connection with experiments. And therefore, doing the entanglement calculation is for the 3D case is very much like doing a quantum oscillation measurement. And it gives you exactly the same data, allows you to determine the Fermi surface. But that's in 3D. In 2D, because you only have one direction for the magnetic field, you can only measure the area of the Fermi surface, but you cannot determine its shape. But using this trick, you get a 1D projection. You can actually also construct the 2D shape of the Fermi surface. So in this sense, the entanglement measure of Fermi surface is more powerful than quantum oscillation. You have a question?
Yeah, so I wonder if you have
multiple cases. That's more difficult. So in this particular paper, we only considered convex Fermi surface and a single piece. But I'm pretty sure, but on the other hand, we only considered the simplest way of cutting it. I'm pretty sure that if you explore all ways to cut it, you can actually determine whatever Fermi surface shape you can. But Xinhua has left and he has to work on for different professors.
So.
Yeah.
Oh.
They add up.
Yeah.
Because if you remember the formula, there is an absolute value.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So this is only just a flash. Okay. So another summary at this point. So we find that entanglement entropy area law is widely obeyed by ground states of local Hamiltonians. Violations are rare above 1D, requires either both of Fermi surfaces. We think we understand both cases reasonably well and even found some use of it, which is we can use it to determine the shape of these surfaces. But then the challenge is, what about highly excited states with a finite excitation energy density? And as I mentioned, the expectation is that now you should actually expect the volume law instead of the area law, very much like the thermal entropy or what would happen when you have a random state in Hilbert space. But the problem is that it's actually even more difficult to study entanglement properties of excited states. So again, let's actually go to the simplest case, which is free fermions, which actually is highly non-trivial as we now appreciate from the entanglement perspective, or I guess from the tensor network perspective. I don't know how easy it is to actually construct a Fermi C state using tensor. Anyway, so here the trick that we use to show the volume law is to invoke this momentum and the real space duality. So as I mentioned, in order to define an entanglement property, you have to specify the momentum space boundary and the real space boundary. And I already mentioned that in the continuum where we have this Gilf-Clich or Witten formula, the log coefficient is actually invariant under the exchange of these two boundaries. So actually, it's not just the log coefficient. The entire, as it turns out, the entire entanglement spectrum is actually invariant under this exchange. It actually only takes a few lines to actually prove that, basically invoking the fact that when you have a free fermion state, two-point function, Green's function, determines everything. And the two-point function, which of course is a matrix, can be written as a product of some projection operators, which is kind of obvious, right? Because you have to project to the occupied subspace in momentum space. That's how you define your state. But then you project a two-point function into the subspace in real space where you actually have the support. So it's completely elementary to show using the fact that when you square the projection operator, you get the original projection operator back, that when you exchange these two, you actually get the same spectrum. So what we did is to use this duality to actually establish a duality relation between ground and excited states. So the way to do that is to let's start with a ground state. Well, what do I mean by that? I haven't even told you what the Hamiltonian is yet. What I really mean by that is I have a regular shaped Fermi C, which is contiguous, okay? So that would definitely qualify to be a ground state. You can certainly write on Hamiltonian, which have that as ground state. But I'm going to do a very unusual cut in real space. Instead of the nice contiguous real space cut, I'm going to actually have a very fragmented cut. So I have bits and pieces here and there. Well, this is a ground state. This is unusual but the legal way of cutting the system. So the area law would actually apply. Well, forget about the log, which plays no role at all. But as long as my grain size of this cut is of order the lattice spacing, you'll find that the area is proportional to the volume. They're the same thing. So the area law will give you an entanglement entropy that actually grows with the volume of the system. Is that obvious? Okay. So now applying the duality, my nice Fermi surface would actually translate into a nice subsystem boundary in real space. But my unusual way of partitioning the system becomes a very unusual occupation pattern in momentum space. But that's nothing but a highly excited state. And these two problems have exactly the same entanglement spectrum and same entanglement entropy, and therefore they both must follow the volume law. So in this particular case, the volume law and the area law are the two sides of the same coin. Okay, so. Yeah. Right, so that can actually be a ground state of different Hamiltonian, local Hamiltonian. So I would call that an atypical highly excited state, which I'm going to comment on a little bit more later. Yeah. So that's if you would. Yes, 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 yes. So if you wish, I guess I'm also going to comment on that. So I don't think integrability plays any role here, actually. Yeah, so you would normally expect the opposite, which is if you have an integrable system, it does not thermalize, and therefore you should actually have the area law instead. So this is actually such a trivial integrable model that we wouldn't even call it integrable. But the volume law actually comes out actually in two lines of argument. But actually, I guess as usual, Xiaogang has anticipated some of the things that I am going to get to now, which is the following. So here we find that for typical highly excited states, you have the volume law, which would be a prerequisite for thermalization, but not sufficient, because that just tells you that the entanglement entropy and thermal entropy scale the same way, but they're not necessarily the same thing yet. So one step further is to actually show thermalization, which means not only the entanglement entropy scale the same way, but also is equal to the thermal entropy, or maybe even further, not just the entanglement entropy, but the reduced density matrix correspond to that of a that of a sumo density matrix. And that's what we are getting to now. So let's look at such a typical highly excited state. And as I said, because this is a free fermion state, in order to prove it thermalizes, all what I need to do is to prove that the two-point function is equal to a thermal two-point function. So let's calculate the thermal two-point function, okay, which is a straightforward exercise, which can be written as a summation of these occupied states. So as we learned in the STAT-MAC course, when you see such a summation, you want to turn that into an integral, which unfortunately I cannot. Because in order to turn this into an integral, I need the thing to be summed over to be a smooth function of k, but it is not because it's jumping back and forth between 0 and 1. So I cannot do this usual trick of turning the summation into an integral. But let's actually divide and conquer. So let's try to smooth it by dividing this summation into two steps. The first is to actually divide the momentum space into many, many cells. And I want enough points in each cell so that they would average to something that's smooth. So the idea is to I first do a cell summation, which yields some average value of this n, which will be smooth. And then I sum over all the cells. And because that's already smooth, that summation can be turned into an integral. But there's one problem, actually, which is this is not the only thing to be summed over. There's also this phase factor. And when you look at different points in the cell, this phase factor is actually changing. But if my subsystem is small enough, then the distance between two points within the subsystem is actually limited. So under appropriate condition, which is, so I guess I reversed the order of the statement. So the point is that if we are allowed to average this n in these cells, then you would get something smooth. And then, of course, you can turn this into an integral. But the problem is that this is not the only thing in each cell, because you also have this phase factor. But this phase factor would actually be more or less a constant if your subsystem is small enough such that you can find a cell size that is big enough to contain many points in momentum space, but small enough such that within each cell, this phase factor is more or less a constant. And this is possible under this condition. So under this condition, I'm able to actually eventually, not that straightforwardly, but turn this summation into an integral. But for atypical excited states like this, I'm not allowed to do this because this coarse graining does not smooth this distribution. But as we see now, in this limit, the appearance of this type of states has zero measure. Okay, so therefore the procedure is to find the appropriate cell size with this condition that allows me to do both the averaging within the cell and the neglecting the variation of this phase factor from one cell to the other, and then first to do the cell summation, which actually turns this 0, 1, 0, 1 occupation into something that's smooth, because it's a summation of these 0, 1s, and find the most probable value of that. And then that's something smooth, and then I can turn this into an integral. Well, if I don't put any constraint on these occupations, then the most probable would be 1/2. But typically, if I ask you for an excited state, you tell me something about the excited state. The most natural things are the particle numbers and the energy. So therefore, the optimization search is a constrained optimization with fixed energy and fixed particle number. So therefore, the outcome should have two parameters. Not surprisingly, one is temperature for inverse temperature, and the other is chemical potential. And if you remember what you, how you actually derived, there are different ways to do that, but if you remember how you would get the Fermi-Dirac distribution, that's precisely what leads to which, what we get here. Because it's an optimization based on the constraint of total energy and total particle number. So we find that this coarse-grained distribution is nothing but the Fermi Dirac distribution with the temperature and chemical potential corresponding to the particle number and the energy of the excited state. So then you can do the integral and find that the two-point function is precisely the thermal two-point function. And because this is a free fermion theory, if you have proven the two-point function is thermal, then everything is thermal. But this only, again, very importantly, applies to these so-called typical highly excited states, but not these atypical ones. But as I already also said, in this limit that the subsystem size is sufficiently small compared to total system size, these atypical states appear as a zero measure. Okay, so so this is actually the last technical slide. So let me actually bring back. So that of course is exactly what ETH claims, right?
So ETH don't claim everyone, claim probably one summarized, but they're still probably zero.
Yeah, so one difficulty is that ETH means different things to different people. So most of the argument we had with the referees is about actually terminology and nomenclature. Yeah, so if you talk to different people, they would actually make stronger or weaker statements.
But what is the correct, so what one expect in quantum system, whether can one really expect, you know, every highly excited state is normalized, or maybe that's not reasonable? One has to say typical or typical.
Okay, so we only looked at this particular case, and that's what comes out. And we were careful in our paper to say that this is a slightly weaker version of ETH, blah, 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 blah. But my gut feeling is that this is about as good as you can get in an interacting system. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so this is the last technical slide, and I bring back the summary of results. We covered quite a few. But again, if you want to go away with one, that should be the last one, which I'm going to summarize again, but yet in another different way. So in this case, make a metaphor. So quoting Charles Bennett, so this is, I guess, maybe appropriate in this place in particular. So perhaps now we start to appreciate that the biggest difference between quantum mechanics and the classical theory is not things like uncertain principles, this and that, but actually entanglement. And Charles Bennett put it very eloquently, I would say, a classical house is at least as dirty as its dirtiest room, but a quantum house can be dirty in every room, yet perfectly clean overall. So you are in a pure state, there's no entropy, but if you look at every single subsystem, you have a lot of entropy because of entanglement. So here's my sort of extension of that kind of metaphor, which is probably not politically correct. So if your life is a mess and has high entropy, don't blame the society, which may well be in a pure and steady state, which in quantum mechanics means a eigenstate. Instead, it's probably because you are entangled with someone who is having an equally messy life. Oh, thank you very much. I guess I'm right on time, more or less.
Typical eigenstates or all eigenstates,
Yeah.
So the way that you're doing this is you're kind of like, am I right that your picture is that, you know, you have a Hamiltonian where the number of, you know, where eigenstates are eigenstates of the number of fermions on each?
Yeah, so I have any non-interacting fermion Hamiltonian will have eigenstates that are single solidic determinants. So
right,
so it's characterized by the occupation number of these momentum.
Right, but okay, but non-interacting is maybe a little bit fine-tuned because you know as soon as I add interactions, if I actually look at eigenstates, that you know what in your non-interacting system is only a typical eigenstate in the interacting system, you know it wouldn't be so surprising if actually all of the actual eigenstates have this property that they're homogeneous.
You may well be right. Yeah. So I was being conservative because this is the only case we are able to say something concrete. And this is, in some sense, the most integrable system. So integrable that we don't call it an integrable system. So. But even with that case, we can actually say quite a bit about symbolization. And any interaction would symbolize it even more. So yeah, you are probably right. Yeah.
That maybe once you add the interactions, you get the strong.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And if I consider that's a if you fine-tune the interaction very, very precisely to make a one highly excited state just like this state, whether that is possible or not possible.
Okay, you have to be a little careful.
So this is a
right.
Maybe for the typical interaction, every eigenstate is symbolized. But for the typical fine-tune interaction, you probably can make a one of them not symbolized. I don't know. Yeah, this is a there's another level.
Okay, so maybe let's just entertain one example, which I don't know if it goes against or along the direction of your thing. So I can always change the sign of the Hamiltonian to turn the highest energy state to the ground state. But that's still a local Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
So at least we know that state obeys the area.
Yeah.
But that's one excited state that doesn't give you some.
But that's a peak.
Okay. So if you insist that you are in the middle of the spectrum,
For this Langlois Fermi liquid, do you have similar results?
See, technically, all our arguments are based on two-point function determining everything.
Yeah, but
once you have interaction, two-point function doesn't tell you everything. So even if I claim that for the Fermi liquid case, the two-point function is thermal, doesn't mean the system is thermal. You know what I mean?
But in Langlois Fermi liquid, can you use its special assumption like this quasi particle there, or kind of?
That's a natural thing to do, but as I said, it's hard to prove anything because you don't have weak theorem. But of course, I mean, we mapped them to boson, free boson. So I would actually be willing to make a small bet, maybe that Fermi liquid has almost exactly the same property, which is you have typical excited states that are thermal, but maybe atypical ones like these are not thermal. But I really don't know how to prove that. Yeah.
Can I ask you?
I thought you wouldn't come, but okay. I thought you would be stuck over on campus. Yeah, go ahead.
Right, so actually this is on an unrelated topic. So one of the things that you showed was that the coefficient of the log term, you know, for the Fermi surface should be relatively robust in the presence of interactions.
Yeah.
You know, even if you add, you know, you kind of bosonize the Fermi liquid.
Right.
And I was wondering if anyone had thought about you know, taking, say, a critical boson and coupling it to that Fermi surface, and like, would you expect that there you would be sensitive also to the, in this leading correct, you know, term of the entanglement, to the central charge of the, or the analog of the central charge
of
the
CFT? Okay, so this is tricky in more than one way. So typically when you couple Fermi surface to critical boson, you destroy the Fermi liquid.
Yes.
Okay, so I can't do much about it anymore, at least with the way that
sure.
we do it. Then the critical boson has some contribution to entanglement entropy itself, which, okay, maybe sub-leading. So there is this result from Woonan Kim, where he and his student, and actually Duncan Haldane and Edward Zai, numerically calculated the, I guess, second linear entropy of the coupling read state, which would be an example of what you're thinking about. Of course, I mean, starting from the mean field wave function in some sense. They found a log whose coefficient is twice as big as this formula that I quoted would predict. But then privately, I heard some of the collaborators are having doubts about that result. So I'm not sure whether that's
with Bloom encryption.
They started with the wave function. So the wave function doesn't know what the Hamiltonian is. So Coulomb interaction presumably would be more stabilizing for the HRR state. But in some sense, they just load the wave function down. I mean, they didn't write it down, I guess. Rezai and Reed and then Haldane wrote something down based on some ansatz, which can be viewed as some mean field version of the composite fermion state. So the wave function doesn't really know about these gauge fluctuations, these critical bosons. But nevertheless, they found the log coefficient, which seems to be twice as big. So my temptation was to interpret that as a Bose surface, which I, as I said, would have twice the coefficient, but there's no reason for that.
So you use strong subadditivity in your derivation here?
No, the strong subadditivity is just to set a rigorous bound.
Okay.
The coefficient is based on the CFT of 1D analog, which is not rigorous.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you expect the same for any entropies?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Do you have similar calculation for this superconductivity? Yeah.
Why would I want to do that? There's no Fermi surface. Oh, you mean for the simulation?
Yeah.
Oh, this actually, as long as you have a free Fermi Hamiltonian, all the arguments go through. Because it's an excited state, it doesn't know about Fermi surface. So as long as the free fermion state, where the two-point function tells you everything, then the argument is identical. So yeah, so you can have mean field superconductors, Majorana, whatever.
Okay. There are no more questions, then let's thank the speaker again.